The presenting sponsor of Top Docs is Netflix, now presenting the documentary film The Greatest Night in Pop from director Bao Nguyen. Variety calls it irresistible, a backstage look at icons coming together for the sake of something greater. The Hollywood Reporter says it's an engaging blitz of nostalgia. The Greatest Night in Pop, now on Netflix. Welcome to Top Docs. This is Mike Merrill, and today we're wrapping up season three with something a little different. We'll be sharing some moments from three of our most popular shows from this past season. You'll hear us in conversation with Laura McGann about her film, The Deepest Breath, Anna Hintz regarding Smoke, Sauna, Sisterhood, and finally, Fisher Stevens will dive into his series, Beckham. I want to take this opportunity to thank you, our audience, and I want to express my gratitude as well to our guests, who unfailingly have been generous with their time and their answers. I always come away from an interview not only enlightened, but also feeling like I've really engaged with the filmmaker, and I hope you feel that way too. First up, I had a chance to speak with Laura McGann about The Deepest Breath, which explores the interconnected fates of two young people who practice the thrilling yet dangerous aquatic sport of freediving. I was drawn not only to Laura's depiction of these young athletes, Alyssa and Steven, but to her interactions with their parents as well. Enzo Zucchini, Alyssa's father, who lives in Rome, and Peter Keenan, Stephen's father, who it turns out is a resident of Dublin. Two of your key characters, I really argue kind of the emotional spine of the film, are the father, Alessia and Stephen, Enzo Zucchini and Peter Keenan. And this contrast between youthful ambition and maybe in some cases even recklessness and this older retrospective wisdom is stark. I think the way you shoot Peter and the kind of near shadow really emphasizes this. Can you talk about working with these two fathers in the wake of all the events of the film?
So I suppose it's interesting the way, and this wasn't on purpose, but we shot Peter's interview first. At the time, he lived across the road from me, which is just a complete coincidence. Wow. I'd been researching the film for about 6 months and talking to different people. And then I was meeting with Peter and he crossed the road, which was just bizarre. We shot with Peter initially in 2019. And then Enzo was the last interview that we did, which was in 2021. So there was 2 years between the two interviews. It wasn't on purpose. It was just with COVID and everything. We were going to go to Rome and talk to Enzo. But also Enzo doesn't have any English. So I couldn't actually sit down with Enzo before we sat down for the interview. And all the other interviewees we spoke to, that was, you know, I had numerous long calls with them all before we did any interview. So it was really a shot in the dark what we were going to talk, you know, how much Enzo kind of wanted to talk about how he really felt about his beloved daughter going to these depths and having to watch her disappear into the darkness and wait until she came back up. I actually became a parent. Our daughter was born in February 2021. So in between those two dads' interviews, I became a parent myself and I suppose became acutely aware of that role and gave it a lot of thought. And one of the things with freediving is that being the person at home must be very difficult. For a freediver, it's a beautiful experience. You get to experience lovely calm, this beautiful free fall, the elation when you come back up. But the person on the surface who's just watching doesn't get any of that. And potentially is quite nervous. And I've seen Alexei, who is the deepest man in the world, his partner. I watched her watch him diving. And it's tough to watch. It's tough to watch. And I could see that she was just having to grin and bear it until he came back up again. And I just thought, oh my God, how it's almost like even more interesting. How do the parents, how does the loved one do it? I knew as well that the kind of felt like the parent is going to be the voice of the audience in a way, you know, and it's going to have those anxieties and kind of reflect them. I also had no idea that Enzo felt the way he felt about Stephen. At the end of the interview, Enzo said that he would give his life for Stephen. Enzo's position there is just one of pure love and heartbreak, you know, for Stephen, for Alessia, and also for Stephen's family. And actually, it was a funny position to be in because Enzo and Peter had never actually been in touch. So when I sat down with Enzo, I had obviously had many, many, many chats with Peter. Peter and Enzo had never been in touch after the accident. There was a lot that hadn't been said yet between the two families. And I suppose I asked Enzo, you know, what would you like to say to Peter if you were to speak to him? He said, I would give my life for Stephen. And I think that meant an awful lot for Peter to hear that that's how Enzo felt. And because there was the language barrier, I think that's kind of part of the reason why they'd never really had a conversation. And I believe that started a conversation between the two families, which I think both are glad they've kind of had now.
After the introduction, the first half of the film really is the stories of the two characters, main characters separate, but in kind of different trajectories, but headed towards each other. And they're kind of entangled almost mystically, but they're different, right? So Alessia really seems to know what she wants from a very early age. We see her in the pool and the sea. Stephen's a bit looser to start. He seems to seek adventure all over the globe, but he's also torn. He talks about living a more conventional life.
Looking from the outside in at Stephen's life and listening to his interviews and his own, looking at his own DV tape stuff that he shot, there seemed to be that conflict, and Peter speaks to it very well as well. There seemed to be that conflict within Stephen whereby he didn't want to kind of be tied down to Dublin, but he was very grounded in his family and he suffered terrible kind of loss as quite a young kid. Peter says this in the documentary, you know, how the family split up and then, you know, not long after that, then his mum passed away. And I think that maybe he was lacking the kind of the new family, you know, you've your family of origin, which he was really grounded in. But even though he did want to go off and explore the world and not necessarily just stay in Dublin. I'm not even talking about freediving. I'm just talking about like experiencing going through the Congo on your own, discovering the meeting people, going up into volcanoes, going down into the middle of the sea. It seemed like he was trying to have both things, which is hard to do. And sadly, at the end of the film, just before the end of the film, he finds what he's looking for. That's what it feels like. He has found someone to share his dream with, which does seem like what he may have always wanted. And then obviously it's just taken away very early and far too quickly. It's a story of, I suppose, finding your dream, but unfortunately not being able to enjoy it.
So he does set up this diving center in Dahab, Egypt, and really seems to be prospering. He focuses on the safety side of things. Stephen's father notes that despite Stephen's wanderlust and his traveling spirit, you know, he traveled with care and seriousness, he says. And I thought it was pretty amazing to see how Stephen's really structured, not just the during this competition in the water sorts of aspects of safety, but even outside. He has a morning meeting with his team. He has this incredible board with every diver and all sorts of things listed for each diver. He's incredibly meticulous about his safety approach.
Yeah, very much so. And the photographer would film each dive, and if a person came up and would black out or not black out, Stephen seemed to really get each diver. A diver might start a competition. I think you have 6 dives in vertical blue. And if your aim is to get to 100, you might start at 91 on the first day. You might go to 93. And he'd kind of know where they were in their plan. He'd know what their plan was. And he would be able to see, okay, right, I think this person's going to push themselves to do 100 here, let's say, but I don't think they should, or I don't think they're ready. So let's be careful. Let's be ready for this person to have a blackout or to struggle. And he'd really kind of have his finger on the pulse of all of the divers there. One of our contributors, who's a respiratory specialist, who is one of the medics there, she really speaks to Stephen, just kind of having that sixth sense about the diver and how they were going to push themselves and what was going to happen.
It's interesting too, in that this diving brings together Stephen and Alessia, and Stephen sees some of the, what he says is mistakes that Alessia is making, and he wants to help her. And it's very interesting to see this sort of issue. I compare it to 100-Foot Wave, another documentary where we see safety drivers and surfers, very similar sort of relationship. There it's long-term, they build up relationships over years. here we really see this incredibly intense thing where we actually see Stephen and Alessia in the water face to face. It's incredibly intimate. The recording is incredible. We actually see kind of their relationship developing on screen. That was my experience. When you saw that tape, what did you feel?
Oh my God, I actually just got goosebumps there as I imagined what I felt when I saw it for the first time. It was just so beautiful to see two people connect without using words. And they were just looking at each other. He was so encouraging. And the opposite to what I've just described is like he could tell if somebody was going to have a hard time. He could tell that she had it in her. And everybody else was kind of, you know, maybe doubting her, saying, God, you should pull back. He could see that she could do it. And that was what was beautiful about his kind of ability to connect with people. Seeing that footage of them just looking at each other and knowing, I've got you, I've got you. And seeing that kind of happen for the first time on the screen was really, really special. There was just no denying that there was an incredible connection there. And it was kind of, for me as a filmmaker, there's a few other moments in the footage that I just found incredibly sad. And I remember like crying when I watched one particular piece of footage, because knowing what we know happened, there was just a purity to kind of the two of them meeting that was just really beautiful. And it was incredibly sad to watch it knowing what was coming down the line.
That was Laura McGann discussing her film, The Deepest Breath. Up next, Ken spoke with Anna Hintz about Smoke Sauna Sisterhood. Smoke Sauna is a tradition in South Estonia, and as you'll hear, it often can provide a safe space for women, including discussion of some of the traumas of their lives.
There's definitely a coexistence of lightness and dark throughout the film, and the film culminates in a very harrowing scene. It's an extremely long scene in which one of the women describes being raped. One of the things that's extraordinary, though, is the way into that story, which is it actually begins as a lighthearted moment where the women are talking about terms they use to self-describe their vaginas. And it's a funny scene. It's a light scene. And then just out of nowhere, it turns into this harrowing story. And then things get very quiet. And this one woman tells this story over many minutes. And it's really just horrifying. And the breath kind of goes out of you as a viewer. This is a woman who we do not see her face. She's holding her arm over her face. But we do see the face of another woman. And then we see a third woman sitting in between them, but not her face. But I wanted to talk about this scene in some depth because it is really the culmination in many ways of the whole movie. And it is truly unforgettable. Can you talk, first of all, about that transition from one story to the next and what it was like for you sitting there as the director?
Yeah, this actually came very organically and unplanned. And this, I think, somehow illustrates this. It's like onion inside us, these layers. You start to talk about something, emerges, and suddenly it hits a very deep thing inside you. A humorous story can also hit something very painful. And actually, this is my story. And it is like, I didn't plan to put it into the film, or I didn't. It was just something that happened in the middle of the Smoke Sauna Sisterhood, where somebody's story like resonated in me and I wanted to share mine. And I, at that moment, I was not the director. I was part of the sisterhood. And then it just came out, and I've never shared this like this, never, ever. It's like my time to share it. It just came. And then actually, I didn't plan.
So that was you?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah. Well, and I didn't plan to put it in because the sad reality is that it's not the only rape story. There are several rape stories. When you are in smoke sauna with women through 7 years, you hear a lot of very painful things that have happened to women. But then we were asking money from Sundance Institute for post-production. And we had to put together like 20-minute sync and like 20 minutes. For that, I asked help from one editor and I gave some hard drives because I still hadn't started the editing process. And I gave some hard drives and I was like, check the material and what resonates with you. And then Martin Mannick, he said, Anna, this is so strong story. This is amazing story. This is, I've never heard anything like this. It's like how it is told, how it unfolds. I didn't tell him immediately that it's my story. I was like giving actually arguments why to pick some other story. He was like, no, this is so strong, like those layers and layers. And then I came out to him and I was like, you know, this is actually my story. And I don't know, I'm not objective at all about it. And I don't know. And he was like, Anna, trust me, let's put it into that 20 minute. So we sent that 20 minute to Sundance Institute and we got the money. We got the funding and it's like super rare, you know, it's like 1% or less to get the funding. And then the Sundance Institute told that this is so strong that please keep that story. So for me, it was an interesting process of somehow validating my own story or like, okay, maybe my story then is so strong. And then it culminated in many, many ways. I actually went to police and I reported and I knew that probably it's too late because it happened when I was underage and then time had passed. But I thought that at least it will be documented that this has happened, even if I cannot anymore do anything against that person or find that person. But at least it's not one of the stories that is silenced because it's happening so much. And I can say that the stories of rape that I heard in smoke sauna, honestly, none of them were reported. And then, it really affected very, very emotionally. And it became like a healing journey for me. And then I was in that meeting this senior officer, like female senior officer in the police. And I was sharing my experience. And still, like, I had done healing for years and still I was there, like, and I was telling, wait, but, you know, I had that red feather in my hair and, you know, I was hitchhiking, like finding excuses that maybe I was guilty. And then she was there and she was like, Anna, you could have been drunk, you could have been naked. This was rape and nobody has the right to do it. Then I burst into tears and it became like another layer of this kind of healing. So it went very deep with it. And now, I mean, when you watch the film, you don't need to know that it is my story. It's not important. I'm one of the sisterhood. But for me personally, it has been, when you ask how it was for a director, it is not there as a director. I'm there as Anna, who unfortunately has experienced this thing in my life.
Thank you for sharing that with us. Narratively, you do have what appears to be a very strong cleansing experience on screen with stomping and chanting and words spoken such as, we sweat out all this pain, we sweat out all that fear. So it does seem like the film itself becomes a healing experience, hopefully for you too.
Yes, absolutely. This was so powerful. It was so powerful. I mean, that's something that I experienced throughout the process where I was inside the smoke sauna and I felt this really powerful energy. I knew that, okay, it will also be from the material. I didn't need to check that at that moment. I knew that it will be also in the material. And it was this healing session, what you described, it came totally spontaneously. It was one of the most powerful smoke sauna experiences that I've ever had. And of course, the real time length for it was much longer. In the film, of course, I had to put it less, not the whole time, but it was like, I don't remember. It felt like timeless, but probably an hour or like something, like just like letting it all out. It was very, very powerful. You know, the whole process of making this film was such a healing experience for all of us who were involved. And now, you know, it's so nice that the sisterhood, they're like sending me many messages every week, like asking how am I doing because I'm traveling so much with the film. I will be actually home, a real home, like having some rest in Christmas time. And they're like, Anna, we are waiting for you and we're going to make a smoke sauna for you to nurture you. And that shows to me that, wow, I feel such heart warmth that you can make films like that. You can make films including the people and the sisterhood now who is supporting me, you know, and nurturing me. It is very heartwarming.
That was Anna Hintz discussing her film Smoke Sauna Sisterhood. Up next, I had a chance to speak with Fisher Stevens about his documentary series, Beckham, concerning the famous footballer and his friends and family, David Beckham. You do a lot of interviews. I really like that sometimes the camera seems more static, and sometimes it seems to move a little bit more. But one thing that really caught my eye was a device that you use. We've talked a bit elsewhere about some of the innovations that we have now. Errol Morris uses mirrors. We were talking about to Davis Guggenheim about how he used what he called like a double lens to interview Michael J. Fox. Here you have this kind of amazing super close-ups where it appears that the subject, David, his father, David Edward or Ted, Diego Simeone, seem to be watching an important game. Their eyes are shifting a little bit. Sometimes we see like a little bit of the image transposed. I didn't know if that was truly a reflection or if you had superimposed it later. Can you talk about what we're seeing here? It's because it's really effective.
Well, thank you. I mean, yeah, God, I love those. We call them eye directs. They're watching the games that we're talking about generally. Like Cantona, like when you see that moment we have of Eric Cantona when he sees, oh my, I mean, like he hasn't watched that in so many years. He's like, we played wonderful football. Like I wanted to capture the essence of the moment and them seeing it. And you can see the eyes and you sort of see into their souls and then you can see their young souls reflecting back. I superimposed the images they were watching sometimes on their face. Sometimes I didn't. We do this in every episode. And honestly, like seeing David like that, I wanted to break him down and the beauty of his angles and his face. I wanted to get rid of it all and just focus on who he is and him watching himself or watching those moments. Again, like for me, documentary, the trying to get into the truth of who these people are is the key. And trying to get to the essence of who David is and who Victoria is was my goal. Those helped me, I think, do that, especially with David, especially with his dad, bringing back those memories. And just even if you don't say anything, you get a moment of their real, true souls.
It seems partly, I think, because their attention is somewhere else. They're not putting on a face. There's someone in front. You know, it's like they're right there. It's so vulnerable.
Yes, vulnerability. I know. I often wonder, you know, we tried to do it. It wasn't easy, you know, to find the spots all the time because of the storytelling. And our movie moves really quickly. So we use those as beats to kind of, okay, now we're going to get into your soul for a second. You know what I mean? Yeah, I love doing those. And I would have done more of them, but sometimes the subjects we didn't have time for, we tried.
Another thing I think it's hard for Americans to fully understand is the importance of international play. It's as important or more important than the league matches. Sometimes you play as a team, sometimes you play for your national team. And Glenn Hoddle, more on him later, builds a whole English team around Beckham, who's just this great midfielder, who's great at scoring, yes, but also passing the ball. What happens in the game is he gets a little extra attention. He's the young star. He gets some like, extra attention on the field, and he retaliates. He kicks Diego Simeone and gets a questionable red card and dismissed from the game. And then England loses to Argentina. It's a whole national rivalry going on there. A couple of things here. One of it is it's hard again for us to understand, but he goes away for a little bit. He comes home to a nation where the entire nation, he feels, hates him. The entire nation. Everyone knows who he is. Everyone hates him. And despite our kind of cliches of British reticence, they seem very willing to express it openly to him, often to his face, to his family's face. And then he has to go up in front of tens of thousands of people for 90 plus minutes at a time and be jeered and attacked and abused. Can you just talk about it? Just the experience that it must have been for him.
This is one of the shocking things that I discovered while making the film, because I was in America, because I didn't understand England's real passion for football, soccer, football. I couldn't believe the abuse that he took from every away fan for years, 2 years, really. It was incredible. And we didn't even say all the things that people would say to Victoria if she was at a game, or David's mother, or David's father. I mean, you got a sense. You certainly get a sense. But the abuse, that's what I'm saying. Like, how does he do it? Then he has the greatest season of his career that season, is able to block it out. His team wins the treble, which makes England, except Manchester fans, hate him even more. Hate him even more. Winning the treble, they hated him. It was like oil on the flames, man. Gasoline on the flames. So it just made him play better. I don't know how the fuck he did it. He has a steel temper. I mean, he's like he's just like a focus. So that was one of the things that blew me away about Beckham, and the fact that he was able to not only survive that, but perform so well. And by the way, he had a great year the next year too, but even the next season, every time he touched the ball, boo, boo, your wife takes it up the arse, da, 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 you know, and yet he persevered.
While I was watching the brief account of Beckham's early years in episode one, I came away feeling, oh, I think something's missing here. And it was only really well into episode two that I understood that not only was something missing, but that in fact, you had deliberately held it back. Episode one shows us kind of the rise of Beckham's incredible skills, but it didn't really reveal what drove him, I think. And here in episode two, about a third of the way through or so, you really show us. And it revolves around Beckham's father, who wanted his son not just to be a great footballer, but to play for Man United, amazingly. Wow. And, you know, one detail that sticks out that is his father has 1,300 to 1,400 of his games on film. Can you talk about the importance of his father in who Beckham became?
Well, it's so interesting you said that. So I have that section in episode one, originally, right? And I was like, it's too obvious for me to put it here, right? It's just, that's where you're going to expect it. I wanted you to feel what you felt like. I wanted you to feel like I still am not sure how this guy got so good, what makes him. The father relationship until he met Sir Alex, it was everything to David. Sir Alex became Ted in a way. Sir Alex, because David really wanted to, like I'm saying, David really wants to impress everyone. He wants to be loved. But he's always going to be an individual. And David's dad, to his credit, was very strict and very hard on him, but he always let David be David. He let him dress the way he wanted. Even as a kid, he would dress a little weird. He let him keep his hair the way he wanted. Ferguson was the first guy to say, no, you can't wear white sneakers, boots. No. Why are you doing that with your hair? What are you doing? And at first, David conformed because he was terrified of Sir Alex. But then he's like, fuck it. I'm going to have to continue to be me because if I don't, I can't even perform on the pitch. And I think Ferguson sort of knew that up until the relationship got to a place that was untenable to fix. Yeah, I mean, that fathers and sons was a big part of our entire film. You know, and then Perez becomes this odd father figure to David, the president of Real Madrid. And he likes to have those father figures in his life. And now I like to think of myself as David's father figure. No, I'm kidding. Not at all. Joke, David.
This kind of his father's training also, I think, gives us another gloss on the opening scene of the second episode. So his father always emphasized control, which could have been, I propose as an alternate title to this episode, control of the ball, but really of everything. And in this regard, this first scene of episode two is a very simple scene on the surface. You know, David makes you an espresso from this beautiful espresso machine he has. Then we pull back to reveal this restaurant grade kitchen, and you note how clean it is. And it turns out that he stays up after everyone else is asleep, cleaning the stove and clipping the candles. And your remark on this is everything has to be perfect, it feels. And it really does feel like this seems to be a form of control too.
Yeah. The reason I wanted to do that is he made me coffee the first day without cameras. And I was like, and then he was fucking fidgeting with everything in the kitchen. And I'm like, what are you doing? And he goes, well, you know, I just, And then Nicola, who works there, was like, David, that's David, his OCD. And I heard about his OCD, but I was watching him like he was nuts. So again, like with the bees, I'm like, David, please, can I film you making coffee? I just want to open it up with you making me coffee. And we just have a little discussion about your compulsion of clean. And he's like, no, no. And I was like, come on, man. This is a documentary on you. And he's like, okay. And like without even missing a beat, the guy, like I pull out a chair and he starts straightening the chair back. He doesn't even know he's doing it. And then you'll see episode four, there's a big payoff to his OCD at the end. That's what I mean. He's very complex and he's not what you would think at all.
You do some really nice work showing his father's influence through some of the mixing of images. So, and editing, you show the young Beckham, we see him on the field, we hear his father's hectoring, and then you interspersed, embedded in film from the period of the crowd jeering him. And he really says, in fact, that without his father's influence, he wasn't sure he would have been able to make it through this period.
His dad was really hard on him. I mean, again, we have another 10-minute scene about his dad. Come on, David. Like the Agassi dad. Not as bad, but very hard on David. The mom said I wouldn't have been so hard on him. But the dad, Ted, really prepped him. He prepared him for this life. And so did Sir Alex Ferguson. The discipline of being a Manchester United youth team player into the first team really prepared David to deal with what you saw in the first two episodes and what you're going to see in episodes 3 and 4, which I don't know how he didn't become an alcoholic, drug addict, wife beater. He kept it together and kept it together with grace, dignity, and continues to be successful in the signing of Messi in Miami.
That was Fisher Stevens discussing Beckham. That's the end of season 3. Over the next few weeks, we will be representing some of our favorite shows of the past few years. And then in a few short weeks, we will start season 4. We hope you'll join us then. Top Docs is a production of Woolly Media. This episode was produced by Ken Jacobson and Mike Merrill and edited by Mike.